This is Main Street. I'm Alicia Haglund-Thorpe. North Dakota is growing and becoming increasingly diverse. In the last decade, nearly 91,000 new people called North Dakota home. Black, Indigenous, and other people of color made up more than half of that increase. Nearly one out of every seven North Dakotans is a person of color. North Dakota children are even more diverse, as nearly one in four children in North Dakota is a person of color. But a recent study released in May 22 shows that even though North Dakota has the third lowest rate of childhood poverty in the country, it has the highest poverty rates for Native American and Black children. Why is that significant? Well, here to tell us about that is North Dakota Kids Count Director Zanna Berg. Thank you so much for being on Main Street today.
Happy to be here.
So before we explore the implications of North Dakota having the highest poverty rates among Native American and Black children and the impact that that has in our state, can you tell us how these facts were gathered?
Yeah, so North Dakota Kids Count, we're a statewide group that compiles data on the well-being of children across the state. Our data covers a wide range of topics. It includes health and wellness, economic security, education, early childhood, and on and on. We compile the data from many different sources. Some come from public sources like the Census Bureau. Other come from specific requests from state agencies like the Department of Public Instruction, the Department of Human Services. That data wouldn't be as readily available, and so we request that and make it accessible online. Kids Count, it's a national network, so there are other Kids Count grantees in every state doing similar work.
Okay.
Kids Count has been around for many decades, and we've been committed to looking at data since then.
So why is reporting data by race necessary?
Yeah, so when we were thinking about this report, we really had two goals that we wanted to accomplish. One, we wanted people to understand that looking at data by race is really important to understand that children of color face more barriers to achieve their full potential. Data isn't often reported disaggregated by race, and we think it's important in order to understand the full story to disaggregate by race and look at where disparities might exist. The second piece to this, though, is that present-day disparities really have lots of systems and history behind why they exist. And we wanted this report to start exploring some of those systems and some of the decisions that were made many decades ago for some of them, how that led us to today. In this report, we told only a fraction of that history, but understanding the why behind a disparity helps us make decisions going into the future to start undoing some of the harm we've done to communities of color.
So going back to this message here, nearly one in four children in North Dakota are a person of color, a Native American or Black or others. This information released, like I said, from May of 2022, it really shows some startling facts. I'm reading here, the report states that as a result of generations of discrimination and racism, families and children of color in North Dakota face more barriers to economic opportunities. They face more limited access to high-quality education and must navigate an underfunded healthcare system that makes it harder to be healthy. So what are some of the examples that you can share, for example, about healthcare or education?
Yeah, healthcare is a great place to start. So when we think about access to healthcare, one data point that we can look at is the number of women, pregnant women, who seek out prenatal care during their first trimester. The data shows us that less than half of babies born to American Indian mothers started prenatal care in their first trimester. And overall, the number is about 80% that seek prenatal care during first trimester. So we're seeing that there's extra barriers for American Indian families to accessing health care. And if we start thinking about the why behind that, so we find that the federal government has treaties in place that offers health care to American Indians. Mm-hmm. And they do this through the Indian Health Service, or I might call that the IHS. When we look at funding for the IHS, though, it's been chronically underfunded by the federal government. So IHS receives only 57% of the per-person funding as Medicaid. So what this really means is that many American Indian families who rely on IHS for their health care, they're not always able to access comprehensive care when they need it. So that history of the treaties and the underfunded health care system really is why we see some of the disparities in access to health care today. The education piece is another area where we see disparities. So children of color have lower graduation rates. And when we look at the data, both by race and rural and urban status, we see that American Indian students in urban school settings experience the most barriers to achieving that on-time graduation rate. So it's 64% of Indigenous students in urban school districts graduate on time compared to 86% of all students in urban districts. Again, these present-day disparities are shaped by systems. So if we look at the research that's been done, BIPOC students or students of color in North Dakota are more likely to be disciplined in school, they have less experienced teachers, and they're less likely to attend preschool. So all of those systemic factors make it harder for students of color to stay on track and succeed. The system is really working against them, not for them.
How else are you seeing this play out then with housing?
Yeah, so we started this piece talking about the poverty, and I think, you know, poverty is what ends up being discussed when we talk about economic security. And it's not a bad data point to look at, but when we start thinking about true economic security, it's not just about living above poverty and having enough money for the day-to-day expenses. So when we think about true economic security, it's often accumulated over generations through building wealth. And owning a home is one of the biggest assets for families and one pathway to economic security. Unfortunately, there were racist policies in place many decades ago that made it harder for families of color to qualify for loans to then purchase a home. Now, housing discrimination based on race is not legal today, but that legacy of the racist policies in the past does persist.
Are you talking about like redlining?
Yep, okay. Talking about redlining. So in North Dakota, using data from today, so if we want to try to understand how that the legacy of redlining impacts today's kind of home ownership rates, North Dakota families of color are still denied mortgage loans at a higher rate compared to their white peers, even when you control for income. So we're still seeing that legacy persist in home ownership, which we know is one pathway to building wealth over generations.
Are you seeing where people are getting turned away from mortgages?
Yeah, that's what the data is showing, is that the families of color are denied at a higher rate for mortgage loans. There is an organization that looks at housing discrimination across the state, and they're investigating even more than just mortgage loans. And there was a report back in 2014 that looked at some of these discriminatory factors within the housing system specific to North Dakota.
Okay, we're speaking with Zanna Berg, director of North Dakota Kids Count, discussing the May 2022 report showing that children of color in North Dakota aren't getting the supports that they need and how North Dakota can improve on this. So now that we're sharing this data, what are some of the recommendations that you can give? Or is there something you want to talk about before we share your recommendations?
There might just be one more data point I want to highlight. So the last kind of topic we talked about in this report is the transition that children make from adolescence into young adulthood. And when we talk about this transition, we think a lot about education and other training programs like apprenticeships. And those are great pathways for students to find good-paying jobs that they find meaningful. I do just want to point out, even for people who have a bachelor's degree, people of color earn $4 less in median wages compared to their white peers. Again, this is comparing within people who have bachelor's degree. And that $4 an hour is super significant. Mm-hmm. If we think about working full-time over the course of a 30-year career, this means that people of color are missing out on nearly $250,000 in wages. $250,000 is about equal to the cost of a home. So going back to that conversation about how owning a home helps you build wealth, all of this is really interconnected.
I see that. Yes, absolutely. What are some recommendations and how can others make improvements to these facts? I mean, does this come down to lawmakers making changes, or is it other positions of leadership? How does that work?
Yeah, so we have recommendations for each of those four topics in our report, and they really touch on a couple of different levels of government. So there are recommendations in here that could be implemented at the really local level. So thinking about, people that are elected to school boards, what can they be doing to help support their students of color in their school system? There's also recommendations in here for state policymakers. So the representatives and senators that represent our districts, there's things that they can be thinking about at the state level. There is also some federal recommendations in here as well. So it's really at all levels of elected policymakers, as well as the people who are working in state agencies. We also think of them as policymakers who are making decisions that impact how we spend federal money and offer services and programs. But if you're listening to this and you're not a policymaker, which is probably the majority of people, I think there's still a role that people can play. Number one, there's somebody that represents you at all levels of government that you can be discussing some of this information and how it impacts you. The second piece of it, this report explored some of the history behind why we see present-day disparities. We could only sum up so much of that history in the six pages of this report. And so really wanting people to think about what else can they learn about the history of their community, of their state, that can help them understand what has shaped their community.
So on the report, you give like each section, like education, here's a recommendation. Housing, here's a recommendation. So are you able to get into a little more of what some of those recommendations are for policymakers, for the general public?
Yeah, so the education piece we can talk about. So I do just want to point out that there's been some exciting progress in the area of education. There was a bill that passed during the 2021 session that made Native American history a required part of the curriculum. And having a more culturally relevant education is a proven strategy to help Indigenous students both feel a sense of belonging but also improve their academic success. So even though that bill's been passed, we're calling on our elected officials to make sure schools and educators have what they need to fully implement those curriculum requirements, and to also think of this as the first step and to be thinking about what other laws can we pass at the state level that are going to support our Indigenous students and their academic success. Another piece that we're looking at in terms of healthcare and access to healthcare, Medicaid, it's a federal program. And when we look at some of the data around children who are eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled, North Dakota has some of the lower participation rates. So about 83% of eligible children participate in Medicaid in North Dakota. So when we think about how do we reach more children who aren't currently accessing healthcare, one place to start is with those children who are eligible but not enrolled in Medicaid, because we know they're eligible for a comprehensive healthcare program. Let's make sure that children who are eligible are enrolled.
What have you seen like on parents filing reports for Medicaid for their children, for example, and not receiving it?
Yeah, during the pandemic and the time in the last 2.5 years, there have been some policy changes to the Medicaid program that are really helping support families and children. And so that's been a good thing to see. One of those is continuous eligibility, where families who qualify for Medicaid, instead of having to reapply more frequently, they're eligible for at least a year. And we've seen nationwide, at least, that that's really helped with the children's health insurance access piece.
Was there a report that you had not too long ago about how the implications of COVID are affecting families?
There was a national report that looked at how COVID impacted families. And one piece that we're thinking quite a bit about as we watch the data long term, education was greatly impacted by COVID. And so we're looking at things like high school graduation rates and how those have changed. We're really seeing that some of the more recent data isn't showing huge drops in graduation rates. So that's one good initial sign. But we're going to need a little bit more time to see kind of what those long-term impacts are. Economic security is another big piece of it. When we think about what challenges families faced during the pandemic, you know, access to employment, being able to show up to work if you didn't have sick time and, you know, maybe you lost some wages, really thinking about what impact that had on families. So looking at some of those economic security data points over time as well is something that we're keeping an eye on.
So what's next for Kids Count? What do you have coming up?
Yeah, with Kids Count, we're always collecting data and looking for where trends are changing rapidly. So you can check out our website at ndkidscount.org to find our most recent updates. We're also thinking, leading up to this session, about what it looks like to support children and families during early childhood. So coming up this fall, we're going to be looking specifically at supports around childcare and early childhood in North Dakota and what state policymakers can be thinking about during the next session for supporting those families.
Thank you so much, Zanna Berg, Director of North Dakota Kids Count. To see this report in its entirety also, you can go to ndkidscount.org and find out how you can make a difference. Thank you for being on our show.
Thanks so much.
Up next, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Brave Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association and The Walk to End Alzheimer's. You can support Alzheimer's research and support programs in North Dakota by participating in a walk. ALZ.org/walk. Where there's a walk, there's a way.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, it's our annual 4th of July show, and we have three special guests join us.
Lindsay Chervinsky, our friend from the 10 Things Initiative here at the Jefferson Hour, our old favorite, Joe Ellis, and the famous Chrysler.
It's always fun to talk about the 4th of July, President Jefferson's favorite holiday.
Jefferson opened the White House twice per year, once on New Year's Day for a reception, and once on the nation's birthday, the 4th of July.
And of course, there's that argument about the 2nd of July.
Joe Ellis, of course, as an Adamsite, believes that the 2nd of July was the day that really brought us our independence. But Jefferson's Declaration of Independence was adopted unanimously on the 4th of July. And as usual, Jefferson won the legacy.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Bison were hunted to near extinction at the same time as the European cow was brought to the Americas. Cattle quickly became the most dominant meat eaten here. But as Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports, combining those two breeds into something better is a niche market that some hope becomes more widespread.
The farmers market in Rolla, Missouri is pretty typical of those in the Midwest. You can buy beef, pork, eggs, vegetables, and baked goods that are grown and made nearby. But one stand sells something different, beefalo. Shopper Vicki Gustavsson is a fan.
It's a bit leaner, so I think it's more healthy for us. Tastes good. We sometimes cook it in the crock pot, a roast, and it comes up nice and tender every time.
Beefalo is exactly what it sounds like, part beef, part buffalo. And the meat available at the Rolla Farmers Market comes from the farm of Andrew and Kelly Deitch. About 25 female beefalo, most with a calf nearby, are grazing on the 650-acre A&K Ranch in south central Missouri. They look a lot like regular cows, but their hair is a little longer and they look a touch bigger in the shoulders. Kelly Deitch says these animals combine the best of both worlds.
And as we like to say, when they created beefalo, they bred out the meanness but kept the leanness of the bison, so kept the good qualities of the bison.
And beefalo were definitely created. While there was some unintentional crossbreeding when European cows got into buffalo herds in the 17th and 18th centuries, it wasn't until the 1970s that a reliable, fertile crossbreed was produced. The intent was to get the lean meat of bison into an animal that could be raised as easily as a cow. And the magic number of 37.5% bison was found. Andrew Deitch used to raise cattle, but finds the beefalo much easier and more enjoyable.
I mean, they all have different personalities, and you can tell them apart because of their colors and such like. But when you have a field of Angus out there, it's hard to tell, you know. I just like doing the beefalo because they're a lot easier to work with.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture certified beefalo as having higher vitamin levels, nearly a third less cholesterol, and 79% less fat than conventional beef. John Fowler raises beefalo in northern Missouri and is on the board of the American Beefalo Association. He says it's a superior animal. The biggest hurdle, getting ranchers to start raising them.
If I can get a person who has a crossbred herd and put a beefalo bull in his herd and then him eat some of the meat, he's sold. he'll want to produce the beefalo.
But beefalo does have its opponents.
We just don't really think that there should be beefalo.
Martha McFarland works for the advocacy group Practical Farmers of Iowa. She also raises cattle and bison, but would never mix the two. She says nature did just fine producing bison, an excellent animal that's also good to eat. But she does empathize with beefalo producers. As a bison and specialty beef producer herself, she knows trying to sell a niche meat is difficult.
A lot of times there, it's hard to find that like middleman to get my meat into the grocery store. I'm not part of this huge mechanized system. My challenge is your average consumer wants to just like go to the grocery store and pick up some food and be done with it.
Beefalo isn't in many grocery stores, and it's primarily sold online or at farmers markets. It also costs more than beef, largely because it comes from small producers. But breeders like Andrew Deitch are still optimistic about the future of the specialty meat. He credits new leadership at the American Beefalo Association.
They've got some new people in there who have really good ideas, and they're reaching out there. They have a Facebook page, and you can find beefalo all over the country.
Deitch says while he and his wife enjoy selling their product at three farmers markets, they're really excited by the prospect of getting more ranchers interested in beefalo. I'm Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative covering all aspects of agriculture. Coming up, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Eastern, and we'll learn about a genealogy project in Pima County. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The owner of the Rugby Wind Farm will be paying a $24,000 fine for failing to install light mitigation technology by a deadline spelled out in state law. That deadline was December 31st of 2021. The common light mitigating system is called ADLS for Aircraft Detection Lighting System. Rugby Wind asked for a waiver in meeting the state deadline as it was looking at another system called LIDS for Light Intensity Dimming System. Public Service Commission Chairman Julie Fedorchek says the PSC held an informal hearing on that.
We did some additional research with the FAA and found out that the FAA was not very close to providing approval for that technology.
Fedorchek says Rugby Wind started to pursue the ADLS system but asked for another delay, but that request was denied on December 29th. The lighting system was installed and operational by the end of March. Fedorchek says the original fine was supposed to be $48,000, but she says an agreement was reached with PSC advocacy staff.
They basically cut the fine in half, recognizing that there were some supply chain issues and other outside forces that contributed to the Rugby Wind's delay.
Fedorchek says the original fine was based on $500 per day charged to two other operators. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has announced a new pilot program to convert agricultural waste like field residue and manure into construction materials and consumer products. As Katie Pikus reports, it's an effort to fight climate change and bolster economic development in rural communities.
A lot of food waste goes to landfills, which emit methane into the atmosphere. The Agriculture Department wants to turn that waste into something more climate-friendly and useful. At a creamery in eastern Iowa, Vilsack announced $10 million from President Biden's infrastructure law to develop a roadmap to do this. Vilsack says the program can help livestock producers, for example, prevent manure from entering rivers and streams.
You find an alternative use for that waste. You separate the water and the solids, for example, in manure. You reclaim the water. Why is that important? Because we're faced in some parts of this country with serious water shortages.
Vilsack says the program will help farmers make more money and bolster jobs in rural areas. I'm Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
And central and eastern North Dakota could see some scattered severe storms throughout this evening. Jennifer Ritterling is a senior meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Grand Forks. She says right now they're expecting storms to develop over the Minot and Devil's Lake areas. She says those storms will move east as the evening progresses. Ritterling says some isolated areas could receive significant impacts.
There's some uncertainty as to, how many storms will form because there's a lot of factors that will kind of limit storm coverage, but any storms that do form will have the potential for some hail and some winds and winds up to 70 miles an hour, hail up to 2 inches, that sort of thing. So it'll be something to definitely keep an eye on this evening as storms move east.
Ritterling says residents should stay aware of their surroundings and have an easy plan to be warned of any severe storms. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Alicia Heglinthorpe. Tom Ezern is a balladeer, a farmer, and a distinguished professor of history at NDSU. Each week, he shares a Plains Folk essay here on Main Street. And today, he shares an essay titled, Their Best Days Are Over.
George Armstrong Custer is not a source I ordinarily would cite as to geographical terminology, but let me draw attention to a hopeful distinction he makes early in his memoir, My Life on the Plains. He remarks how school children were being taught to refer to the midsection of the country as the Great American Desert. This should stop, Custer says. He insists that the so-called desert has no abiding place, his words. Instead, the region is now known as the Plains. It is important what you call the place you claim as your own. To my Dakota and Lakota friends, it is Makoche, home country, always has been. It is the Euro-Americans who disagree as to terminology. Walter Prescott Webb, author of the 1931 classic, The Great Plains, attempted to brand the region once and for all. The level, treeless, subhumid middle of the country should be recognized, he says, as the Great Plains. And the name stuck. I used to cite all sorts of anecdotal evidence about the prevalence of the term Great Plains that I use all the time here in Plainsfolk. I have theorized that Webb, by the power of his ideas, essentially created the named region in the public mind. So Great Plains became attached to highways, museums, research centers, implement companies, software firms, you name it. Literally, you name it, in order to declare such entities as being of this place. Now it is possible to track this naming and branding exercise through the written evidence, beginning with the Google program it calls the Ngram Viewer. This allows you to chart the appearance of a particular phrase through the entire body of books digitized by Google. This is not all books, of course, but it is a mighty big sample. So I ran the phrase, the Great Plains, through the Ngram Viewer. And the results were a little surprising. It turns out the rise in its currency predates Walter Webb. Its use in books becomes significant in the 1880s and rises fairly steadily to 1920 when it increases markedly. Just about precisely in 1931, the year of publication, remember, for the Great Plains, usage spikes sharply upward to peak in 1938. From this evidence, I am inclined to conclude that Webb did not coin his titular term. Rather, he adopted it from rising popular usage. It does appear, however, Webb's book spiked the rise of the phrase, the Great Plains, during its heyday. Except, there was something else going on. Out of curiosity, I also ran the phrase, the Dust Bowl, through the Ngram Viewer. Dust Bowl has a bullet in usage from 1931 to 1939. So here's my revised theory. Walter Webb was attempting, self-consciously, to establish a region, the Great Plains, through publication of his book, The Great Plains, in 1931. He adopted the phrase from rising popular usage and accentuated it in the popular mind. He got some unexpected and, I presume, unwelcome help from the advent of the environmental catastrophe known as the Dust Bowl, which afflicted, of course, the Great Plains. It was hard to talk about one without the other. Here, then, are some takeaways for those of us who call ourselves Plainsfolk and consider the Great Plains our place. When my great-grandparents arrived and took up farming in the 1870s, they did not call their land the Great Plains. They did not call it the Midwest or the Middle West either. The generations of my grandparents and parents, they invoked the term Great Plains, but also endured the Dust Bowl. There are other terms to sort out, terms like Northwest, Midwest, High Plains, but I think now I have a handle on the Great Plains.
That's Tom Ezern. Next week, he tracks down an old ballad called Cattle King's Prayer. Up next, a feature about the Pemina County Cemetery.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Touchmark at Harwood Groves, Fargo, and on West Century in Bismarck. Touchmark offers maintenance-free living so residents have more time to enjoy what they love. Fresh prepared meals, health and fitness club, and a full calendar of events with friends nearby. Learn more at touchmark.com.
Get inspired to explore the California coast.
You may be lucky enough to see whales offshore.
Take in a rodeo.
To hardcore, longtime cowboys, saddle bronc is a classic event.
And hear why the bald eagle is perfect as the American national symbol.
The eagle conveys attributes that we associate with the United States, strength and courage and freedom.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street. I'm Alicia Heglin-Thorpe. Genealogy has become part of the world's culture, with cemeteries playing an important role in tracing one's roots. The Pemina County Historical Museum has the ambitious goal of gathering all the county's cemetery records into a central, searchable location available to the public. Special contributor Brandy Malarkey visits with Zelda Harchi, administrator for the Pemina County Historical Museum, to learn more about the scope of the project.
We have quite an extensive library at our museum, and a lot of people come to do genealogy. And cemeteries are a major part of that. And we have over 50 cemeteries. Like when people say, well, can you help me find my family's grave site? And I don't even know who keeps the records for some of these. So we've talked about it for a long time, and what really spurred us was we found a cemetery, an unmarked cemetery. We're still working on who's buried there, but we have found 12 graves there. So we want to streamline it for people who are looking for graves, because it's amazing how many people need that connection that they make when they find a grave, you know, a headstone and everything. It's just really amazing. It's an extensive project. And last fall, we decided to go for it. Let's see if we can get some money to help us do this.
How do you find, it's you don't just trip over a graveyard.
Well, it was so interesting. There was a man who kept detailed journals. Oh, I can't remember the dates, but it's like over 100 years ago. And we got copies of these journals. And so I brought one home to read, 5 or 6 years ago for the winter. And it was really kind of neat because he talked about my husband's grandmother when she was a child. And I'm reading along, and this man was such a devout Catholic. And he lived right by Leroy. Leroy was one of the first settled communities by the fur traders, okay? And some of the first missionaries were stationed there. And this man is extremely devout Catholic and went to Mass basically every day. All of a sudden, I'm reading, and he said that he went to a funeral, a Lutheran funeral, just west of Leroy where they buried this person. Okay. At that point, for a devout Catholic to go to a Lutheran funeral was a pretty big deal because they just didn't do that. And he talked about this church and this cemetery. Well, there's a large Catholic cemetery there, and there's a large Catholic church. Nobody had ever heard of this Lutheran cemetery. So I just kept it in the back of my mind. And I think it's 3 years ago, at the museum, I was sorting through papers and stopped to read one. And here it was, a man describing the building of that very church with a legal description and talking about the cemetery. So we figured out where it should be, and we went there, and a couple of us can witch graves. We can find them. And there should have been 15 graves, but we found evidence of 12 of them. So it was just a circumstance thing, but now we have a sign and people know about it.
Well, that's very cool. You get to be a modern day Nancy Drew.
Well, you know, that's what we do at the museum. That's the best part of working at a museum is like ours is all the little mysteries we're able to solve. And a lot of them have to do with people finding graves. You know, they want to know. They want that connection. So they come from all over the country and before COVID, from all over Canada, too. So we decided we had to try to centralize all these records. And at first, we just wanted to digitize church records. Well, I don't know if you've looked at some people's handwriting, but it's not very easy to read. So we decided digitizing wasn't the right thing to do. So our goal is to collect and to basically, we're going to have massive spreadsheets with information. So we'll have everything in a central location and it will be available for the public. And we have one funeral home in the county, and he's very anxious for us to do this because he understands, even for his use, we have to try to find all the cemetery records. For instance, one sexton took the records home with him and took them to work, and then his place of work burned down. So the records are gone. So you kind of have to start from scratch. And so we just need a good central location that people can come to, or we'll be able to email them to them, or whatever.
Or maybe put them online, accessible on your website.
Eventually, our goal is to be able to do that. Now, the Red River Valley Genealogy Society, they did this for I don't know how many counties in the valley back, like ours were published in 1989. Okay, so they published volumes of these. And they have given permission. They now have it as a database. And we will be able to use their information. In return, we will give them our information. And so that way it will also be available. That's a pretty exciting part of this also.
Well, right. I mean, you're discovering unknown graveyards and collaborating.
Yes. Yes. And we'll collaborate a lot. Like I had a friend who passed away last fall, and she was a member of our church. So she's recorded in our church death records, you know, the official records. Her funeral was in a different church, so she's recorded there as a funeral. And then she was buried in a cemetery that's really not well known at all. And so it's things like that that get confusing. So we can't look at just one set of records. We have to look at churches and cemeteries and death records and everything.
So death records from the whole county.
Yep.
And how many churches and cemeteries are we talking about?
We know we have at least 51 cemeteries. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is there a roughly equal number of churches then?
You know, we're losing churches all the time. And that's another part of it. Like I'm Presbyterian. And at one time there were 17 Presbyterian churches in Pemina County. And now there are three. So it's like, where did the records go for all of those churches? If we want to use their death records or burial records, we have to find out where they are.
So really that's the first step in this process is trying to hunt down records.
Yes.
Where it may be a little difficult finding where they're located or who to contact.
Yeah. And so our people have been kind of doing that all winter. And in some cases, it's really surprising. There are excellent records. Others we've come across, they're really sketchy. We have to gather all the records. And then we're going to start with those records that were done in 1989. And people are going to walk the cemeteries and verify the information, but also note new graves. And now, you know, a lot of people aren't buried. They're cremated and never buried. So that's why death records are important, because we want to recognize every death in our county. So then there are people who are buried here who didn't die here. Like a couple years ago, a woman brought her mother's remains to be buried here, and her mother had never even lived here, but the mother's mother had. And she came all the way from Vermont to do that.
So it's a pretty complicated project.
It is. It is.
If you have people hunting down records that you don't know where they are, cross-referencing records where you do know where they are, and also walking individual graves, that's got to be a lot of man hours.
It is. It is. It's going to take a lot of volunteer time. But it's surprising how people have already stepped forward, and we haven't even publicized it, to offer to help. And at the same time, I'm hoping people will want to clean gravestones. But that could take us another 5 years.
This is a lot of factors going into this project.
It is. Our goal is to have someone hired who will do data entry. So like I'm buying a computer dedicated for this and everything. And this person will start with the records that we have. There's a lot of different things that volunteers can do. They can go out there and gather records. They can read through things. They can walk the cemeteries. I have somebody from Bismarck who's already offered to come and walk cemeteries, you know, to look for stones and to verify what's there. Oh, the other thing is, at the museum, we have quite an extensive collection of obituaries. We have about 10,000 obituaries on file. So we want an obituary for every grave or every death. So somebody's going to connect all of that too. We got enough to hire someone for about 200 hours to do data entry and to buy a laptop. Other than that, the museum will put in a little bit of money. It will be all with volunteers. And we hope they're out there.
I hope so, too. This sounds like a great project.
Well, I think it is. I think it is. It's just really necessary. But I should say, too, that are you familiar with Find a Grave?
Vaguely.
Okay. You know, it's a worldwide system. I believe it's worldwide. And we have a couple of members who are volunteers for Find a Grave. And so they can share their work with us. That might help us in an extent. And we have some people who have already done some cemeteries, and they have also like found an obituary, and they've actually published them. And so they're allowing us to use their work too. And then we'll just keep adding to it.
What an incredible community project.
Well, that's how I think of it. And someone from Valley City heard about it, and he contacted a couple of people. Like a school class in Valley City worked on doing this, a high school class. There's a man, I think it's Sargent County. He's in his 80s now, and for 10 years, he's been doing this sort of thing by himself.
Oh, wow.
And he has contacted me, and they've all shared their little tricks and what to do. And then I want to have drone footage of all the cemeteries. That's really out there, you know. But I guess that like big city cemeteries now, you can even use GPS to locate a grave. And who knows, it might take us a couple of years to get to that point. Anyway, you ask how long. I'm hoping that we can get a lot of this done this summer. I believe the grant, we have 1 year to work on it, but I know that it will continue way beyond that because you have to keep it updated every year.
It kind of sounds like your data entry person is hopefully going to help with the initial pull things together in one place.
Yeah.
And
yep.
Then you're working on a lot of volunteers.
Yep. Yep. I'm hoping we can find somebody, you know, you got to have somebody who's proficient because we'd like to even add photos. I'm hoping maybe that person wants to volunteer beyond the time frame or we'll find more money, you know. In fact, there's one cemetery, they had asked me a few years ago if I would compile their information, and they were willing to pay. So I think that some of these cemeteries might be willing to, in return for good records, they would be willing to offer some funds. That's what I'm hoping.
The multi-branch way you're looking at it and approaching it, and the community involvement from so many different places, I think that that's something that is really impressive.
Well, and I hope it will be when it's done. I mean, that's my goal, is it for it to be really community outreach from all parts of our community and bring people who have these interests together. I think there are a lot of people out there who, like me, my husband and I visit cemeteries. I mean, this is just something we do. But I think there are a lot of people like us. You know, who knows what kind of a gathering of people we could become. Like I said, cleaning cemetery stones, that's another whole thing that really needs to be done. Sometimes, like, I get requests for pictures of stones, and we have to try to clean them off first. Oh, another thing we're going to do is do a couple of cemetery walks where we take people on tours of cemeteries. We've done it in Wahala. One of the cemeteries in Wahala is really unique, and the Wahala martyrs are buried there, but it has so many good stories, and we really get a turnout for people for the cemetery walks. And some of the very first pioneers for North Dakota are buried in Pima County. And so we want to remember them and acknowledge them.
If you can pull all those pieces together, it'll benefit a lot of different people.
It will. I think it's just important that this be done in every community, because cemeteries sometimes get ignored. They get overgrown, you know, and we need to take care of them.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me this afternoon.
Well, yes, it's been fun.
That was Zelda Harchi, administrator for the Pembina County Historical Museum, visiting with special contributor Brandy Malarkey about the Pembina Cemetery Records Project. Funding for the project comes from a cultural heritage grant from the State Historical Society of North Dakota. To learn more or to volunteer, check out their website at cavalierND.com/museum. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 29th. A primary election was held on this date in 1910 in North Dakota, except the date was advertised incorrectly multiple times in Billings County newspapers. Quite a bit was wrong, according to the Golden Valley Chronicle. At that time, Golden Valley County had not yet become a separate county and was still a part of Billings County. The county auditor had submitted the details of the election to the papers in Beach and Medora, but the date was listed as June 24th rather than the 29th. And while the township outside of Beach was listed as a voting precinct, it appeared that residents within Beach were not included as voters. The paper reported that notices will probably be posted by the city officials and an election held in the city notwithstanding. Further, no names of any candidates were reported in the notice. There was concern that this would cause botched results and any close race could be contested. The Golden Valley Chronicle wrote, "The county auditor has made a bad mess of the proceedings so far, and it is a safe bet that it will end in court proceedings before it is over." This may have been a simple, unintentional, though sloppy error, But the fact that other county politics were ongoing throughout western North Dakota did not improve the perception. Reports around the state noted various events unfolding. Medora was the county seat, but residents of Beach had their eyes on taking that honor for itself at the next general election. Marmarth, also part of Billings County, hoped to separate and also become a county seat in a new county. Meanwhile, Headinger County wanted to annex part of Billings County. By the end of the year, some of this seemed poised to occur. Voters in the general election had approved dividing the region to create Slope and Golden Valley, though it would be 2 years before Golden Valley would unentangle its border with Billings County. Despite all the confusion leading up to the vote, the job got done. The 1910 results in Billings County, though delayed, were ultimately straightforward. This Dakota Date Book was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Marie Offit.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
There was one room in her house that was always kept locked. It was the garage.
Got something taking up space you don't want anymore?
She thinks my tractor's sexy.
Maybe you want to hold on to that. Ah, how about that clunky? We'll take that RV, heavy farm equipment, and airplane off your hands.
Shirley, you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Just complete our secure online form by going to prairiepublic.org. Just open the support tab and choose vehicle donation. Or you can call 844-440-6900.
That's it for today's Main Street. Tomorrow, Lily Griego, the regional director for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, has been in North Dakota this week, making a number of stops around the state. We'll discuss what she found out. And Sue Belcom is here with advice for shopping at farmers markets. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Join us at 3 and 7 Central. I'm Alicia Haglund-Thorpe. Thanks for listening.